Wow, that's an introduction. I don't know if I can live up to this. I don't know here. If you would appease me, I would really like if people could come forward and we could fill in all this blank space up here a little bit. If you got small children, that's okay. You can stay in the back, but we could just come on up a little bit and start at that first row there. I would really like that a lot. Thank you. This is not your typical Wednesday night topic, so I'll just go ahead and say so. It's that. To me, it's kind of more like a family meeting. If I could get you all in my living room, so that's kind of why I wanted you forward to like that anyway, to be just a little bit closer and all. My subject this evening is about the effects of technology on children. From 1 Chronicles 12, verse 32, the verse there on the board behind me, and the children of Issachar were men that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. So that key part there is of the times. This is our time. Here we are. We're in the 21st century. We weren't born the 1600s. So how do we live in these times that we have now? So some of what I want to focus on tonight, that part of the verse is understanding the times. I'm not even going to address what we ought to do at all, but I want to do that. Now, a little bit of background. For some time now, I have been observing certain behavior in the culture of a lot of people. A lot of these would probably be, say, age 29 and under. I'll just say that I observe things that I would consider to be negative. I ask other people about this. Other people say, yeah, I see the same thing. Yeah, I see the same thing. I talk to my children who are in their mid and late 20s, and they confirm, yes, you are seeing that. And so anyway, as that went on, I began to get more and more curious about this. So I had certain thoughts. I had certain ideas about this subject of what's going on in the culture. But just because I have thoughts and ideas, that doesn't make them right. And so I began to ask, is there a way to know ironclad, concrete facts and data of the questions that I have of, is there something going on in the culture? And I discovered that there is, and there is a lot. There is quite a lot. And so anyway, my curiosity, there it goes, and I start down this path. And anyway, this is some of it right here. This isn't all of it. This is some of it that's out here. When the meeting's over, you're welcome to come look at some of the stuff I've been collecting and all here of articles and things. So I have learned a lot. And anyway, I feel somewhat compelled to share it. So part of our times is that technology is here and it's not going away. I used it today, and it actually worked today. I like it on the days that it works for me, and when it doesn't work, I don't like it as good. But anyway, I did. I used it today. And anyway, I want to also, I think there's a little bit of anxiety of some here, of like, here's this old guy. What's he going to do to us tonight? Let me tell you what this meeting is not. This meeting is not a rant session where I'm going to rant. Okay? So you can relax on that. I'm not going to have an altar call afterwards so we can all burn our phones. I'm not going to do that, okay? I'm not. So sometimes with family meetings, and I think that we are family. I hope we are. I think we are the family of God. Sometimes you just need to talk about some stuff. So I know for right now, I'll be the one talking. I want to give a few minutes for some question and answer at the end, and of course, we'll carry on more discussion and all later on. My goal here for this meeting is that I am going to be a conduit to relay to you information of what I've been learning. I hope to not give any of my own thoughts, at least not tonight. So I'm going to be reporting on what I've learned. I beg to be heard. None of my sources that I have are Anabaptists. I couldn't, if there's any out there, let me know, but I couldn't find any. There are multiple researchers out here of people whose lifetime career is the study of human behavior and recording what do people do, what do they do under certain circumstances, and all those kind of things, and how society and culture can shift or change and things like that. So that's some of where I've been going to and looking at what those people say. What has been so fascinating to me, though, is that there are so many sources who all have come to the same conclusion. That's significant. That's very significant, and all right there. First, I want to start with a little story to give to you about going to Mars. Anybody wanted to ever go to Mars? Any of your children want to be an astronaut, go to Mars? Suppose that when your first child turned 10, a visionary billionaire whom you've never met chose her to join the first permanent human settlement on Mars. Her academic performance, plus an analysis of her genome, clinched her a spot. Unbeknownst to you, she had already signed herself up for the mission because she loves outer space. And besides, all her friends have signed up too. She begs you to let her go. Before saying no, you agree to learn more. You learn that the reason they're recruiting children is that they adapt better to the unusual conditions of Mars, better than adults, particularly the low gravity. At least, that's the theory. It's unknown whether Mars-adapted children would be able to return to Earth or not. You find other reasons for concern and fear. First, there's the radiation. Did the planners take this into account? Did they do any research on child safety at all? As far as you can tell, no. And then there's gravity. Mars has gravity, but it's only 38% of what a child would experience on Earth. Children raised in the low-gravity environment of Mars would be at a high risk of developing deformities in their skeletons, their hearts, their eyes, and brains. Did the planners take this vulnerability of children into account? As far as you can tell, no. So, would you let her go? The answer is there's nobody here at all who's going to let them go. Sending children to Mars? Why would any parent allow it? The company behind the project is racing to stake a claim against their rival competitor before they can get there. Its leaders don't seem to know anything about child development. They don't seem to care about child safety. And worse still, the company did not require proof of parental permission. As long as a child checks a box stating they've obtained parental permission, they can blast off to Mars. No company could ever take our children away and endanger them without our consent. Right? Or right? At the turn of this century, around 2000, technology companies based on the West Coast of the United States created a set of world-changing products that took advantage of the rapidly growing internet. There was a widely shared sense of techno-optimism These products made life easier, more fun, and more productive. Some of them helped people to connect and to communicate, and therefore it seemed likely they would be a boon to the growing number of emerging democracies. This came soon after the fall of the Iron Curtain. Anybody remember that? It felt like the dawn of a new age. The founders of these companies were hailed as heroes, geniuses, and global benefactors. But the tech industry was not just transforming life for adults. It began transforming life for children, too. Children and adolescents have been watching a lot of television since the 1950s. But the new technologies were far more portable, personalized, and engaging than anything that came before. Parents discovered this truth early, as I did in 2008. This is from the author here, I'm quoting. When my 2-year-old son mastered the touch and swipe interface of my first iPhone, 2 years old. Many parents were relieved to find that a smartphone or a tablet could keep a child happily engaged and quiet for hours. Was this safe? Nobody knew. But because everyone else was doing it, it just assumed it must be okay. Yet the companies had done little or no research on the mental health effects of their products on children and adolescents, and they shared no data with researchers about it. When faced with growing evidence that their products were harming young people, they mostly engaged in denial and public relations campaigns. Companies that strive to maximize engagement by using psychological tricks. Now, I'll just tell you that, just like you as a workman, if you have tools in your toolbox, there's psychologists, they have tools in their toolboxes, and there's things that they know that are extremely, extremely clever in manipulating human behavior. And they pull them out, and they use them, too. Many of these, they hooked children during their vulnerable developmental stages while their brains were rapidly rewiring in response to the incoming stimulation. This included social media companies, which inflicted their greatest damage on girls, and video game companies and pornography sites, which sank their hooks deep into boys by designing a fire hose of addictive content that entered through kids' eyes and ears, and by displacing physical play and in-person socializing. These companies have rewired childhood and changed human development on an almost unimaginable scale. The most intense period of this rewiring was from the years 2010 to 2015. Now, I know that I've mentioned their social media, and I also know that the church policy and all here is we have no social media. That is our official policy. I am going to mention social media anyway, because I do know there's some here that would like to have it. I also know that it's just, it's close. It's not far away from us at all. Another thing that I have learned a whole lot of is that I'm thankful for what we have with Compass and our filtered phones and things. There's kind of a technological warfare that's going on all the time between filter providers. There are lots and lots of parents who are not in our churches. They have filters for their phones for their children. The way things have been going, though, for like these 20 years or so, is you have filters, and then people figure out ways to get around them. And then the filter companies come up to how to undo them, and then they figure out how to come around them again. Children as young as 11 years old have been very successful in figuring these things out. Now, I know I've spoke even with just Mervin recently, that as far as we know, we think things are pretty good with Compass right now. But I guess what I'm saying is that if you as a parent, you give your phone to your child and think that your phone is bulletproof, I hope it is. And it might be. But 6 months from now, it might not be. And these children, they coach each other and tell each other how to do this, and they figure these things out. So anyway, and this is not, what I'm saying is not isolated. It's not uncommon. So anyway, because of that, I am going to mention some about social media. 40% of American children under the age of 13 have created Instagram accounts. Now, that's actually illegal. You're supposed to be 13. All you got to do is check a box and say that you are. That's it. And also that goes on. A few of these companies are behaving like the tobacco industries, which designed their products to be addictive, and then they marketed them to children, especially. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco got in a lot of trouble. They were accused of promoting their product of tobacco to children, to young people, which they were doing, and they were highly successful at it. They denied it, but it finally came out, the long story. Yeah, we did. We did that. So anyway, now, though, the tech companies, they don't even really deny it, that children are targeted. Now, of course, there's an enormous difference between big social media companies and, say, the big tobacco companies. Social media companies are making products that are useful for adults. And yes, that is true. The same is not true for minors. While the reward-seeking parts of the brain mature earlier, the frontal cortex, which is essential for self-control, delay gratification, and resistance to temptation, is not up to full capacity until the mid-20s. Okay, did you get that? This is the research they've done on MRI, brain scans, and all this, and study of human behavior. Not until the mid-20s is the elements of self-control, delayed gratification, and resistance to temptation are those things fully matured. We use this word called maturity. That's part of it there. We've all seen where sometimes as people age from their youth to their adolescence and teen years and into their 20s and closer to 30, that it's like, well, maturity starts kicking in. They start making better choices and things. There's some reasons behind that. So, adolescents, children, they are often socially insecure. They're often easily swayed by peer pressure. They're easily lured by any activity that offers validation. It says, I'm worthwhile, I'm important. The cost of using social media in particular has been high for adolescents compared with adults, while the benefits are minimal. Now, in using terms here of, I'm using terms children, adolescents, youth, basically I'm talking, there is some overlap with adults too, but I'm mostly talking 18, 19, and under. I know there's a lot of difference between a 6-year-old and a 16-year-old. I know that. But I also know that your 16-year-olds, I don't think anybody's going to let them get married today or go buy a house or buy a farm and start a business. They're not quite there yet at all. So anyway, just to clarify that. Now, we know what causes generations to differ goes beyond the events that children experience. Now, they've got all these generational names, and I didn't come up with them, but they have one to talk about here. One big one is Generation Z. If you're 29 and under, you're part of Generation Z, they call it. Generations are labeled a lot by some of the things that happened to them. So, like my parents and grandparents, World War II, the Great Depression, those were huge factors that shaped thousands of people of that culture. Besides, though, just things like that, it includes changes in technology today. Those also affect what we call of generations. So we had early 1900s radio, then there was television, then there was personal computers, then the internet, and then the iPhone. Just for the record or whatever there, I did grow up with television. Not proud of it, but I did. Y'all all know that. The data on that for like when I was growing up, about 3 hours per day would have been average of children watching television. That's what that would have been. Of course, averages are average and all that. Okay, around 2009, there were several tech trends that converged: the rapid spread of high-speed broadband, the arrival of the iPhone in 2007, and then we had hyper-viralized social media. Before 2009, social media was most useful as a way to keep up with your friends. It was different. It generated much less of the toxicity that we see today. A fourth trend began a few years later, and it hit girls much harder than boys: the increased prevalence of posting images of oneself after smartphones added front-facing cameras. That was in 2010. This greatly expanded the number of adolescents posting carefully curated photos and videos of their lives for their peers, and not just for their peers and friends, but for strangers just to judge and to see. Generation Z became the first generation in history to grow up with a portal in their pocket that called them away from the people nearby and into an alternative universe that was exciting, addictive, and unstable, and unsuitable for children and adolescents. Succeeding socially in that universe required them to devote a large part of their consciousness perpetually to managing what became their online brand. This was now necessary to gain acceptance from peers, which is the oxygen of adolescence, and to avoid online shaming, which is the nightmare of adolescence. They watched increasing quantities of user-generated videos, streamed entertainment offered to them by autoplay and algorithms that were designed to keep them online as long as possible. They spent far less time playing with or talking to or making contact with their friends and families. This reduced participation, in embodied social behaviors that are essential for human development. Generation Z, therefore, was the test subjects for a radical new way of growing up. So this became what authors are calling a phone-based childhood or a screen-based childhood. That is what our culture has moved to. Now, when you say a phone-based, it can be tablets, it could be a desktop, it could be a laptop, it can be any devices. A lot of them lean towards the phrase of a phone-based because that one is by far the most popular one. The central claim here of this author says that overprotection in the real world and underprotection in the virtual world are the major reasons why children born after 1995 have become the anxious generation. Anxiety is a big thing. Now, just a few notes about terminology to compare and contrast when I talk about the real world versus the virtual world. The real world is embodied. Okay, we are right now, we're experiencing the real world. By embodied, you are here with your bodies present. The virtual world is disembodied. Nobody has to be there physically present. The real world is synchronous. Synchronous means in synchrony all together at the same time. So we just have some of that. We sang songs. We sang a couple of songs together, all of us embodied as people. You can't do that in a virtual community very well. The real world involves primarily one-to-one or one-to-several communication. It's happening right now. That's what's going on. In the virtual world, you can broadcast to a potentially vast audience. The real world takes place within communities of real communities, and people are strongly motivated to invest in those relationships. In the virtual communities, those communities tend to be short-lived, and those relationships are often disposable. Okay. We have for more than a century of experience, let's see, in making the real world safe for children. Automobiles became popular in the early 20th century. And guess what? Tens of thousands of children died in automobile accidents. So we eventually mandated seat belts in the 1960s. Then we mandated car seats in the 1980s. When I was in high school in the late 1970s, many of my fellow students smoked cigarettes, which they could easily buy from a vending machine. Anybody remember those things? I sure do. Eventually, America banned those machines because it was too easy for children to get cigarettes. This inconvenienced adult smokers. They had to now go into a store and purchase them from a store clerk who could verify their age. Over the course of many decades, we have found ways to protect children. As evidence mounts that a phone-based childhood is making our children mentally unhealthy, socially isolated, and deeply unhappy, are we okay with that trade-off? Or will we eventually realize, as we did in the 20th century, that we sometimes need to protect children from harm, even when it inconveniences adults? So what would the sages of long ago advise us today about managing our phone-based lives? Even those who simply scroll through a bottomless feed featuring the doings, rantings, and goings-on of other people will appreciate Marcus Aurelius' advice in the second century. He said this, "Don't waste the rest of your time here worrying about other people. It will keep you from doing anything useful." Just like that. Second century. Many of us have become more frazzled, scattered, and exhausted by our new technologies and their incessant interruptions and distractions. As AI enables the production of super realistic and fabricated photographs, videos, and news stories, life online is probably going to get even more confusing, and it's going to get more than what it is even now. But it doesn't have to be that way. We can regain control. We can choose a different path. So the most rapid rewiring of human relationships that has happened to us in human history has made it harder for all of us to think and to focus. Is that 20 till? It is, isn't it? Okay. That's my introduction. Well, I knew that it would be like this. That anyway, I have a whole lot and all. I do want to say this, that it's like if you're a young person and all here, and it's like you're not depressed, you don't have anxiety, you're not experiencing a lot of these negative things, I'm so glad. I am so happy that you are not having some of these things. However, the data is so strong of what has been happening in the world. The data that I have comes from the United States, Canada, the Scandinavian countries, Europe, Australia, New Zealand. This is what's called the Western, what they would call this, the Western world. And after smartphones came to that, youth and children especially had their own smartphone. The psychiatrist clinics and wards blew up that they had so many and everything in there. And from anxiety and depression and all these other things that happen, it's so much that we cannot ignore it or say it's not there. But anyway, if it's not happening to you, I'm thrilled. I'm happy for you. So I don't want to say that every single young person has this. But there is enough that do. That it has, we have had this negative and all stuff, that we have to at least look at it and say what's going on. There's no other answer, everything to, for it, except the smartphones there. It would have to be something in the water, something in the food supply, something in the air. There's nothing else that answers any of this. A lot of these researchers and stuff too, they're not coming at this from a Christian worldview. They're just coming at it from, this is happening in the culture and why. And also, anyway, this is the tip of the iceberg. Any questions, whatever, here. I'll just, anybody have anything? Feel free.
Just curious, based on your research, what would you suggest application would be?
I'd probably rather save what we should do for a little bit later. I'd like to finish this and everything first. There are some that are suggesting something they call internet adulthood, which are basically saying, let's get a foundation on children first, that children need to grow up in the real world, not the virtual world. They need to grow up in real families with real communities and have real life experiences instead of all these other experiences. The minimum average of young people, the time spent on devices and all is 35 to 40 hours a week. According to the IRS, that's a full-time job. There are some that say even 50 hours. Pew Research Center has said that one-third of teenagers admit to being on their phones constantly. They admit that. So it's like it varies, but it's a lot. And so if you're living that much of your time in the virtual world, even if it's not immoral or bad, it's like there's something called opportunity cost. So the 35, 40, 45 hours a week, you could be doing something else that you're not doing. So is that a good trade-off? That's also what some of the research is saying. Is that a good trade-off? So anyway, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When do children generally get phones first, like in society?
When do they get what?
When they first get phones. Is it when they go to school?
It keeps lowering. The age keeps lowering and lowering. I've been watching it for a while now. I know people right here in Van Leer, grammar school, you know, their child in elementary school here. And and parents, what's interesting is parents are so concerned of safety, and I am too, you know, they are so concerned. It's like, I want to be able to reach my child any moment, 24/7 at school or wherever. Is that right there? So, you know, that's some of their reasoning. And all of that. Yes?
How much does the education system, like public schools, how much are they utilizing technology? I mean, am I correct in thinking that most of their lessons are now done on laptops, computers?
I'm hearing that. I think that's right. And I'm wondering if they're even reading books, paper books anymore. And I'm thinking less and less from what I'm hearing. I don't know 100%, but I think it's less and less. I would actually like to know, but I haven't got to the bottom of that question and all. The other thing that happens with, that has happened with all, and see, really, a screen-based life, it started when I was a child. It started with television. This is just more of it and everything now. It started then. And what they do know also is that as the screen-based life increases, guess what decreases? Something called reading. Reading decreases. Guess what the Bible is? I think you read it, I believe. You know, so it's pretty boring if that's what you're feeding. If you're feeding and living in the virtual world, and then you get this book to read, this is not going too good, you know, because you're used to all that other stimulation. and all there, or so if you're used to so much of it and all like that. So anyway, yeah, we have a view here of, you know, that it's like as long as content is not immoral, then it's like it's okay. But the data bears out otherwise, that just even what could be not immoral, but if you have 40 plus hours a week of it, it does have an effect on you that is different. So, you know, the best I can tell, I think civilization's been here 6,000 years. And this is between 2010 and 2015, that's when most children got their own phone, teenagers and all that. And since then, we have had a radical change of humanity. This is the largest social experiment ever performed on children in human history that nobody really knows the outcome, except really in the last year or two, the outcome is looking kind of grim, not too good and all here. So yeah. Yes, Wayne. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I dumped up. Sorry. I don't know that one there. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm out of time. If you want to hear more, let me know. If you don't, then I'll be quiet. I guess so. Just let me know. Thank you for your attention. Mm-hmm.